All right, so we have our turn Simons functional attached to an oriented three manifold M, trace of A wedge dA plus 2/3 A wedge A wedge A, where this symbol TR just denotes essentially the Killing form on the Lie algebra of G, which I always normalize such that this turn Simons functional is circle valued with period 2 pi. Okay, and so there's a standard procedure to extract perturbative invariance of oriented manifolds and knots from this classical field theory. I'll mostly be interested today just in the story for knots. So for really the application that I'm interested in, M is just going to be a Euclidean space, and then the knot will be interesting. But a lot of the things I'll be saying will be true for general M, at the start anyway. Okay, and so if we want to extract knot invariance from Chern-Simons gauge theory, we want to look at some observables attached to the knot, and the observable is just the Wilson loop operator. So here is an example of a knot, a very simple knot. So the knot I'll always call C. C is just an oriented curve smoothly embedded in M. And then to define the Wilson loop operator, I attach to C an irreducible representation V of the gauge group G. And again, in perturbation theory, the choice of V isn't really going to matter as long as V is non-trivial. And then the Wilson loop operator just is a classical functional of the connection A. It's just the holonomy. So I write the Wilson loop associated with the representation V and the knot C. It's just the trace in the representation V of the holonomy computed for some choice of base point on C. So the trace in V of the holonomy, which the physicists would usually write as the path ordered exponential of the integral around C of A. So that's the Wilson loop operator. Okay, and there are many approaches to extracting perturbative knot invariance from this classical field theory with this operator inserted into it. They're basically, you could roughly say there's an algebraic approach, there's a topological approach, and a geometric approach. And what I'll be talking about today is really the geometric formalism, which comes most directly from the quantum field theory. So in that approach, in the geometric approach, what we do is we consider a sum over Feynman graphs, where the Feynman graphs are trivalent diagrams with some endpoints attached to the knot. So one of the most basic Feynman graphs we would draw in the usual formalism might be this graph attached to three points, say x1, x2, and x3, which live on C. And then there's another point trivalent vertex is, which is some point moving around in R3. And so the essential ingredient in this standard formalism is the propagator, the Chern-Simons propagator, which is just what we assign to the lines in the graph. And so the propagator I always call K. And so the Chern-Simons propagator is a very nice in this formalism has a very nice, if we make a suitable choice of gauge, has a very nice cohomological interpretation. So let me just remind you of that. So to describe the propagator cohomologically, I introduce a map. So the propagator will depend on the two endpoints of the line. So I have a map from R3 times R3, and then I will subtract the diagonal delta to the two-sphere. So delta is the diagonal. And I just make the map that takes the two points, x and y, which are distinct, to the direction from one to the other. And then this propagator has a nice cohomological description, again, with some appropriate choice of gauge. It's just the pullback under this map, this difference map gamma, of a unit volume form on this two-sphere. So then the propagator is just a closed two-form defined on this face. And in fact, there's a standard formula for it. Maybe I'll write it right here just to kind of orient you. So kappa is equal to, in the standard Einstein summation convention, epsilon, totally anti-symmetric tensor epsilon, x minus y mu, dx nu wedge dy rho, normalized by the cube of the Euclidean difference. So that's just the pullback of the standard unit volume form. Okay, so intrinsically what this propagator means is it's just the integral kernel representing an operator, the operator which is inverse to the appropriate gauge fixed version of this Durham D right here. And so it happens that, with the right choice of gauge, you get this nice cohomological interpretation. All right, so what the role of this propagator is in the kind of geometric way of thinking about perturbation theory, which is really, I think, articulated most clearly back in the 90s by Bott and Taubes, is what we do is we have a configuration space of points either on the knot or in the three manifold M, which is just R3. This diagram tells us how to attach, how to make a top form on that configuration space just by putting together appropriate numbers of copies of this base of this two form K, such that we can, and then we integrate that top form over this configuration space. So for example, for this diagram here, I have three propagators. So therefore I have a form of degree 6, and that's exactly the right dimension to describe the moduli space of three points moving on this one dimensional curve, and then the extra point Y moving around in the interior. And the Feynman diagram calculus just tells us how to put together those integrals of forms of different degrees on these configuration spaces together to make a topological invariants of C. Well, that's actually the story in the best of all possible worlds. It's actually not, literally speaking, true, what I just said. And the reason it's not sort of on-the-nose true can be seen just by considering sort of the most basic Feynman diagram, the Feynman diagram that doesn't have any interaction at all. So I have just here my knot. I won't worry about the embedding. It's just an abstract S1 embedded in some way. And then I have the propagator connecting the two points on the S1. So attached to this diagram, I'm supposed to consider, say, a regularized integral over two copies of C minus the little neighborhood of the diagonal of my propagator K. That would be the most basic invariant I might try to make. You might think about this as being a kind of self-linking invariant of C, because of course if I were trying to do the same thing with a link or not a knot, this would just be describing the Gauss version of the linking number. So you can consider this, and if you think about this kind of integral for just a little bit, you'll see that first of all, that this does define some real number attached to this embedded curve. So you do get a real number from this, but what you don't get, this real number has no particular integrality properties, and it's not any kind of isotopy invariant. So you actually do not find a knot invariant in this naive procedure. And the reason this isn't an isotopy invariant is that if you just ask what happens to this quantity if you vary the embedding by a little bit, well, K is a closed two-form. So if you vary the embedding by a little bit, what happens is K will just vary by something which is exact, D exact. And so if the domain of integration were compact without boundary, we'd be done. There'd be no variation. But in fact, there is a boundary because we had to remove the diagonal because the propagator is not defined along the diagonal. And one finds that, so there is a general boundary contribution which will depend on epsilon. And then the question is, when we take epsilon to zero, do we get something non-zero or zero? And in fact, the transient propagator does not behave particularly well in the UV. So there is a finite remainder residue when epsilon goes to zero that says that this integral just varies in some random way depending on the geometry of the knot when we try to vary it. So this kind of naive procedure doesn't actually work to give us invariants. The way to fix this, of course, is well known. We have to regularize the Wilson loop operator. And the simple way to do it is to do physically a point splitting. Mathematically, we just frame this Wilson loop, which means that we replace the Wilson loop, the knot, by a ribbon. So we have a little normal displacement vector everywhere on our curve, and we use this normal displacement vector to separate the points that we would have met here along the diagonal. And so in this kind of perspective, what this framing does is it gives us a prescription to add a counterterm, a local counterterm on C, whose variation under the variation of the map exactly cancels the variation of this. In fact, the counterterm would just be the integral of the geometric torsion of the knot. Okay, so the issue with the standard approach to perturbation theory in this geometric formalism is just that order by order, if you want to make actual, first of all, you don't make actual knot invariants, you make frame knot invariants. But if you think about it perturbatively, to make that work, the framing means that order by order in perturbation theory, you have to add these effective counterterms, associated to the boundaries of this moduli space of points moving on the knot in R3. And you have to add them order by order in such a way that you cancel all these anomalous variations. So that's kind of a defect, I would say, of the usual approach to Chern-Simons perturbation theory. So one of the basic motivations for what this project is about is just to give a formulation of perturbation theory which doesn't have this anomaly. So the naive procedure, if you give me a Feynman graph, I just write down forms to integrate over this configuration space, actually produces on the nose invariants. Okay, so the issue from this kind of physical way of thinking about the problem is just that the Chern-Simons field theory and the propagator don't behave particularly well in the ultraviolet. So it's natural to consider other field theories which behave better in the UV to effectively regulate this Chern-Simons theory. And so a kind of obvious thing to do is to consider not starting with the Chern-Simons functional itself, but adding a Yang-Mills term. So the starting point for this other approach to perturbation theory is to consider not just the Chern-Simons functional, but the Yang-Mills Chern-Simons action in three dimensions. So the Yang-Mills action, let me write it here. So I'll just call it I. It depends only on the connection A, and I'll write it as minus 1 over 8 pi e squared integral over m. M is now just an arbitrary compact-oriented three-manifold of the trace of the norm square of the curvature plus I k Chern-Simons functional, where FA is the curvature, k an integer is the Chern-Simons level, and e squared is just my notation for the Yang-Mills coupling in three dimensions. All right, so the first thing to say, of course, is the point of this is that the Yang-Mills, because the Yang-Mills term has two derivatives, that automatically means that the propagator will have a softer UV behavior than just we would find for the propagator for the first order Chern-Simons action. So that's kind of the good thing about considering this Yang-Mills Chern-Simons action. Of course, the bad thing is that this action now depends on, beyond the Chern-Simons level, it depends on the extra data of, well, the Yang-Mills coupling, and then the, kind of more importantly, the metric that I put on the three-manifold to define the action. So of course, really, the dependence is not, there's not, there's the dependence is, the situation is a little bit better than that. There isn't really a separate dependence, of course, on both the coupling and the metric, because I can consider, if I say, fix a fiducial metric, so I have some metric G defining this Hodge star, and I can imagine fixing a fiducial G. So I'll write G0 is just a fiducial G, and just consider what happens to this Yang-Mills action in three dimensions if I do a rescaling of G. So I just do some rescaling, lambda is just a real number. And of course, under this rescaling of G, the Yang-Mills action in three dimensions transforms homogeneously. And so really the role of this Yang-Mills coupling E is just to set the scale of the metric. So so I can either imagine fixing the fiducial metric G and then changing E amounts to changing the scale, or I can fix the scale and then vary E. And of course, the way it works is that when E squared is small, that's the same as taking the metric on my manifold into very small, the radius is small. And when E squared is large, that means my manifold is large. So of course, if I want to recover the ordinary pure Chern-Simons theory, that's like taking E squared to infinity, which is the same as making my manifold to be very, very big. So the trouble with that, though, is, of course, if just scaling my manifold to be very, very big to recover something topological, I don't learn anything, because then I'm just back to the Chern-Simons action that I started with. So really the first kind of step in this program is to consider other So basically, to consider other geometric limits for this metric on the three-manifold. If I just give you a random three-manifold with some random metric on it, the only limits I can really consider are the manifold is either very big or very small, because there isn't any structure. So the first thing to do to get this formalism to work is to consider special metrics on three-manifolds, and by considering degenerations of those special metrics, to look to new versions of basically new what you might call quasi-topological field theories.
Like that, you still don't get an integer. I mean, you still have to have some contactors, or do you get an integer?
That's a good question. It would be strange to expect that the results would be totally independent of, I mean, they will depend in some way on E squared, so it's hard to see how from this formalism you would find an integer without flowing all the way to
and
the infrared.
You cannot get an answer which does not have the Fermi anomaly.
That's right. That's another way to say, yeah.
The constant you described, which is integral of the torsion.
Yes, that is the standard.
That involves the metric.
Yes, it does, yeah, because how would you define the torsion without?
The bus is the constant that emerges here.
That's quite possible, actually, yeah.
What does it emerge there to? I don't know, because
here,
find epsilon, I guess.
That's right, yeah. Epsilon, if we had a metric, we can define epsilon by taking some. Right, yeah, I will not be working, yeah, somehow this is, yeah, somehow we'll be getting rid of most of the dependence on the metric here, so. Yeah, of course, the idea of regularizing Chern-Simons gauge theory by Annie Yang-Milstar, of course, is kind of not a new idea at all. The idea is, I think the new idea is just to try to simplify this Yang-Milstar-Chern-Simons term to make it more like a topological field theory. Right, okay, so we want to consider special, rather than considering sort of a random metric on our three-manifold, we want to consider a special metric. And so what do I mean by a special metric? Well, one way to say what you mean by a special metric is to say that we want a metric which reduces the structure group. So kind of a random three-manifold, the structure group of the tangent bundle will just be all of SO3. If you want a special metric, we should try to reduce the structure group of the tangent bundle. And so concretely what that means is we want to put a metric on the manifold that's compatible with a local decomposition in every tangent fiber. So if we reduce the structure group from the kind of the obvious way from SO3 to SO2, we want to have a local isomorphism in every tangent fiber of this three-dimensional vector space. It's just R times the complex plane, where the structure group now would just be the U1 rotations in the complex plane. So this would be an example of putting how to think about putting a special metric on the three-manifold. And the different choices I can make as to exactly how I want to pick a metric that reduces the structure group in this way. I'll make what is in a certain sense the most robust choice, in the sense that it works for all compact-orientable three-manifolds. There are other choices, other topological choices would involve, I might have to put more assumptions on my three-manifold, but this is a very robust choice. And so to describe the choice, what I'll do is, well, first of all, if I have this kind of decomposition in every tangent fiber, what it means is I have a family of two planes defined on my three-manifold, first of all. And so I'll call this family of two planes H. H is the two-plane. And so if I want to specify a family of two planes on a three-manifold, I can always, assuming that these two planes are everywhere orientable, I can always do that by thinking about H as the kernel of a non-vanishing one-form that I put on my three-manifold. So I think about H as the kernel of a one-form kappa. And now this choice has a little bit of a kind of conformal ambiguity. So kappa is a non-vanishing one-form. And of course, I can always multiply kappa by any non-vanishing function f, and that will not change the kernel. So specifying H and specifying kappa are not quite equivalent. Specifying kappa means that I have this residual rescaling kind of conformal ambiguity. But anyway, I can specify my non-vanishing kappa and get an H. And then the important condition that I'll make, so this is something kind of totally general, but the important condition that I'll make on my plane field H in terms of the one-form kappa is that I'll assume that d kappa is a symplectic form on H. So I'll always assume that d kappa restricted to every plane H is non-vanishing. So this is the contact. So kappa is going to be a contact form. H will be a contact structure. And this is the contact condition. So my plane field anyway had to be orientable because d kappa orients it. Now associate, if I have this one form kappa, which is non-vanishing, with the property that d kappa is also non-vanishing, I automatically get for free a vector field, which will describe the transverse direction to this plane field. This vector is the rev vector r, and it's just determined by the conditions that the contraction of the vector with kappa is unity, and the contraction of the vector with d kappa vanishes. So I need the contact condition that this is non-vanishing to uniquely specify the rev field with this condition. And so it follows immediately from these two properties that the flow, this rev field has a nice property that the flow preserves kappa and therefore preserves the plane field H. Okay, so if I have this, so if I give you this data, and then I also pick, put a complex structure. So I really mean I want an identification of these planes with C. I have to also pick a complex structure. So I just pick a tensor, which everywhere squares to minus one on these planes. And then I can attach to my three manifold M a metric which realizes this reduction in structure groups. So the metric kind of has the obvious form. It looks like a Hermitian metric on H, and then there, and then the metric is such that the rev direction, the rev field is orthogonal with unit norm. So this is the associated contact metric. As I said, the nice thing about this package is that I don't really need to make any assumptions. I make choices when I put this structure on my three manifold, but as long as M is orientable, this package exists. Now, a couple things to say. First of all, because I've reduced the structure group, in this family of metrics, there's actually I actually have a two-parameter family of metrics here, because of course I can scale both of these terms independently. So let me actually parameterize those metrics in terms of a parameter I'll call T and another parameter I'll call little r. I'll choose some particular choice of scaling here. So little t and little r, both positive real numbers. The metric on the planes I scales is t over r, and the metric in the rev direction scales like t squared. And so of course the point of this is that if I scale t and r together such that r scales inversely to t, that would just realize my homogeneous overall rescaling applied to this Yang-Mills action, we would just recover Trin-Simons theory. But there are others, now I have a two-parameter family, so there's another way to scale. There's another way to scale and consider what happens. Actually, before I say that, let me just point out, so the volume form on my manifold M with this choice, with that parameterization in terms of T and R, scales like T squared over 2R times kappa OHD kappa. And again, it's a consequence of the contact condition. The kappa OHD kappa is always a non-vanishing top form everywhere on M. And I always orient M such that this thing is positive. Yeah, so the point is that there's another infrared limit now if I assume my three manifold has this kind of contact metric, because I can get to the infrared not necessarily scaling T and R together, scaling these two terms of the metric differently, so I get an anisotropic infrared limit. Actually, there's one more thing to say about this family of metrics here, which is kind of interesting, which is that I've defined a Euclidean metric on my three manifold here. But I could equally well put a Lorentz signature metric on my three manifold just by changing the sign of that term. So it's kind of a curious fact. In higher dimensions, it's not really the case. I mean, just use some random compact N manifold that will have a Lorentzian metric. But for compact orientable three manifolds, it is true that they all admit both Euclidean and Lorentzian metrics. And it's kind of important for the story, actually, that we have the freedom to work in both Euclidean and Lorentzian signature. So here I should say, I've written this is the Yang-Mills action in Euclidean signature. It's a complex action. This term is real. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to consider to try to get a different kind of what you might call quasi-topological field theory. I want to consider a different infrared limit now on my three-manifold, what you might call an anisotropic infrared limit. And in this anisotropic infrared limit, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to consider my Yang-Mills Chern-Simons action in the limit where I take the parameter I call t to infinity, but I keep the parameter I call little r fixed. So this is also an infrared limit, but it's an infrared limit in which I scale the Reeve direction to be much bigger than the planar directions. And so the good thing about this limit is if I consider what happens to my Yang-Mills Chern-Simons functional, is that I get something which is sensible in this limit. So I'll write the result of this limit just by normalization as I times k over 4 pi times some action f of a. And I put the factor of k in front of this because we're going to be doing perturbation theory. So k, if you like, is always a large number. And so this is the natural way we organize perturbation theory. And so then you can ask where, what is this action f of a? If we take the Yang-Mills Chern-Simons action and consider this kind of metric with this anisotropic infrared limit, what you find is that the action f of a, well, it has one term, which is just the Chern-Simons term, which of course doesn't depend at all on our metric. And then the interesting thing is that it has another term, which is left over from the Yang-Mills action. So in general, when we scale, in general, the Yang-Mills action in three dimensions, there's basically an electric term involving the components of the curvature along the Reeve direction. And there's a magnetic term involving the components of the curvature on the planes. And in this anisotropic infrared limit, the electric piece of the Yang-Mills action scales away, but the magnetic piece on the contact planes stays around. So if I take this limit, I find with this normalization of the action, something that looks like I times a coefficient involving this metric parameter r, which is fixed, the Yang-Mills coupling in k, and then a term integral over m, volume form, and then basically just the square of the magnetic field on the contact planes. So a trace of. So this term that I write is kappa wedge FA divided by kappa d kappa, this is just representing the square of the components of the curvature along the contact planes. All right, so let me call this parameter here, r over e squared k, this parameter will be important, so let me give it an, I'll call it beta. So in general, this parameter beta, I allow myself to think about beta as being a generic complex number. When beta is real, that just means I'm working with this Yang-Mills Chern-Simons theory in Euclidean signature. And when beta is purely imaginary, that just corresponds to working with the Lorentz signature metric. And in general, when I do perturbation theory, I can allow beta to be any complex number. Another kind of interesting feature of this action is that the action apparently depends on the choice of the contact form kappa. But actually, if you think about it, you can check that under this local rescaling of kappa by multiplying by an arbitrary function, this term actually is invariant under that. It's obviously homogeneous. It's for constant rescaling, it's obviously homogeneous. And actually, if you allow any local rescaling, you'll find this term is invariant. So this term in the action is quasi-topological in the sense that it only depends on this two-plane field H. It actually doesn't depend on the one form kappa that I picked to represent it. So really, this action only depends on the orientation of m, and then this choice of oriented plane field H on m.
Is there more that you can do? Wait, is there a solution in case such that this fact is obvious?
That it doesn't...
Wait to write down the formula without choosing the cap back?
That's a good question. Offhand, I don't have an answer. I have to think a little bit about that. It's not very difficult to check that it actually, it's basically, all one needs to know is if you make the local rescaling of kappa, then kappa where it's d kappa scales just like f squared times kappa. So that's basically all you need to know. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the perturbation theory that I'll be talking about comes from studying the perturbative invariants that come from this action. So of course, another nice feature of this action is this action still has a two derivative term to regulate, which can regulate for us the ultraviolet behavior of the propagator. Okay, now beta, as I say, can be an arbitrary complex parameter, but there are a couple of special values that are worth pointing out. Okay, so the first special value, it's not really a value so much as it is a regime, and that's just to take beta to be small and real. So here, because beta is real, I'm working in Euclidean signature. So the good thing about this action, it involves another choice of this playing field H, but it also gives us another parameter beta. And whenever you have another parameter beta, that's really good, because then you can do perturbation theory in beta. And so here, if you're looking for some way to simplify the usual structure of Chern-Simons perturbation theory, well, having large k doesn't help you because you're already working perturbatively, but then you can hope to find a simplification when beta takes some special value. And here that would be small beta. And in fact, as I hope to explain by the end of the talk, actually perturbation theory drastically simplifies in this asymptotic regime of small beta. So basically, in the regime that this Yang-Mills, this effective two-dimensional Yang-Mills theory on the contact planes is just a small perturbation to the Chern-Simons action. Now, another special value, which is a little bit less apparent, is to take beta equals I. This corresponds to working in Lorentzian signature on the three manifold. So when beta is equal to I, this action is real now. It's a real action. And it has a greatly enhanced symmetry. So I just call this symmetry the shift symmetry. And so the symmetry is just taking the connection A, which is the only field in the game right now, and just adding to A the contact form kappa times sigma. So sigma is just a scalar field valued in the Lie algebra. And it's not hard to see that the change in the Chern-Simons term under this shift in A by kappa exactly cancels against this shift in this 2D Yang-Mills term. So precisely when beta is equal to I, there's this enhanced infinite dimensional symmetry. And so for example, one thing that you can do with this infinite dimensional symmetry is always, even on a compact three manifold, go to what you might call horizontal gauge. And that's just the gauge where you say that the contraction of the Reed field with A is identically zero. And that obviously is a unique way to fix the symmetry. And it has the additional consequence that it kills that the Chern-Simons interaction term will just vanish if we go to horizontal gauge. Another consequence of the shift symmetry is it tells us immediately that there can be no renormalization of the coefficient of this Yang-Mills term here. K can't be renormalized because it's an integer, and then the shift symmetry relates the coefficient of this term to the coefficient of this term. Okay, so the idea is to study perturbation theory for this contact Chern-Simons functional S of A. And then you could ask, well, what observables should we look at? So the observables will be Wilson loop operators, again. But it's natural, especially if you're interested in investigating the theory at the special point beta is equal to I, where it has the shift symmetry, to ask that the Wilson loop operator itself respects that shift in A. So the Wilson loop, I remind you, is just the trace in V of the holonomy of A. And now you see, look at this operator. If you want this operator to be invariant under shifting A by kappa times anything, the only, yes?
So this symmetry, I mean, you could always, even for other values of beta or whatever, you could always make this gauge transformation. And like, this is a valid gauge transformation, and presumably you sort of maintain gauge invariance throughout your whole story so far, so it indeed would leave the action invariant.
That's not a gauge transformation. Yeah, yeah, no, if beta is not equal to I, this will not preserve this action. It's not a gauge symmetry, actually. It's really important. This is not a gauge symmetry.
Exact.
That's right. It's not a symmetry. This is not a gauge symmetry, right? This is sigma's just a, yeah, sigma looks like a gauge parameter, but if you think about how, this is not abelian, so I haven't actually conjugated, for example, A by anything.
Oh,
yeah, so this is not a gauge symmetry.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, so it's just a new symmetry. All right, but it's important, though, as I say, so we have to impose some condition if we want this now. Because it's not a gauge symmetry, we have to impose conditions on this Wilson loop operator if we want that shift to preserve it. And so the only thing we can really do to get this to work, if we want the shift symmetry to preserve the operator, it's just to require that kappa vanishes identically when restricted to C. Then that shift in A will trivially preserve the operator. And so the condition that kappa restricts to C is equal to zero is the same as saying, since the kernel of kappa was what I was defining this family of two planes, it's the same as to say that the tangent line at any point on C lies in this two plane that defines the contact structure. And to say that we have this geometric condition that our knot has this property that this tangent line always lies in this family of planes H, it's just equivalent to say that C is a Legendre knot. And that's the definition of a Legendre knot. Okay, so I've drawn a picture of, I took care before the talk to draw a picture of a Legendre knot on the board here. So I've drawn the picture as usual by choosing a projection in space, and because I have this, and so this is a Legendre knot in R3 with some standard choice of the contact structure. Actually, let me actually make that choice explicit. So for R3, I'll always make a standard choice where, so R3 is just R times C. My contact form kappa. So if I pick coordinates tau and then complex coordinates zeta and zeta bar on the plane, then my contact form I'll always take just to be d tau plus the angular form in the plane. This is a nice symmetric choice. So this respects the rotations in the plane. And then the refield for this, the symmetry of the contact form, which always happens, it's just translations in the vertical direction. So if I make this standard choice for the contact form in R3, what I'm drawing here is a projection of the Legendre knot to the complex plane here, spanned by zeta and zeta bar. And so there are a couple things to say about, so this is an example, so there are a couple things to say about Legendre knots. The first thing is just to say that the Legendre condition is actually a weak condition in the sense that any topological knot you can find, you can move it around a little bit to find a Legendrian representative. So you have all of knot theory when you study Legendre knots. But the equivalence relation on Legendre knots, so we refine the usual equivalence under smooth isotopy to Legendrian isotopy through families of Legendre knots, and that equivalence relation strictly refines the smooth equivalence. So for example, in R3, there's only one unknot topologically, but there are infinitely many Legendrian unknots. So what I've drawn here is a particular Legendrian representative of a truffle, but there are actually infinitely many distinct Legendrian truffles. Another thing to say is that, so one of the nice things about this particular projection is that it will always be the case in this projection that the Legendre knot is a smoothly immersed curve in the plane. So in general, if I give you a topological knot, it will generically be immersed, but it, for some choices, I could see cuffs in my projection. But for a Legendre knot, it's always the case that the projection is a smoothly immersed curve. That'll actually be important for this perturbation theory later. And it's also the case that Legendre knots are always canonically framed. So for a Legendre knot, I always have this non-vanishing rev vector field. And by definition, the rev field is always transverse to the contact plane H where the Legendre knot lives. So the rev field always gives a canonical framing for my Legendre knot. And so that's directly related to the fact that this new perturbative formalism is not anomalous, that secretly there's always this canonical framing.
Projections that it has to be immersed, or is it?
It's in special projections, actually. Yeah. So it's in special projections. So, Legendre knots are very much like plane curves because they're always locally moving in a plane, and so because they're morally plane curves, they have distinguished projections. So there's one more thing to say, and that is, just say as a fact. So I'll be talking about this more on Tuesday, but just as a fact, these Legendre and Wilson loops that I've just defined for this purely bosonic theory, they're ones which can be lifted in the ultraviolet. If I take my ultraviolet Yang-Mills-Chern-Simons theory and add supersymmetry, these are Wilson loop operators which can be lifted to supersymmetric Wilson loop operators in this ultraviolet supersymmetric theory. So that implies, so supersymmetry, the fact that these Legendre and Wilson loop operators have supersymmetric lifts in the ultraviolet, it implies that the expectation value, the kind of standard stuff, the expectation value of this Wilson loop operator has to be independent of, for example, this continuous parameter beta. For example, beta involves the Yang-Mills coupling, and sort of supersymmetric observables never depend on the Yang-Mills, don't depend on the Yang-Mills coupling. So this expectation value is independent of beta, and once you know the expectation value is independent of beta, you see immediately that it's also independent of the choice of contact structure H, and therefore the Legendre knot representative, because I can just set beta is equal to zero, and then I'm back to my purely bosonic theory. Except there's a tiny caveat, so this is independent of H, and therefore the Legendre and representative of my knot that I pick, modulo framing. So of course, the issue is that in the bosonic Chern-Simons theory, the observables aren't defined until we frame them. And so there can be, because of this kind of UV anomaly, even there could be a kind of dependence on my contact structure H, but that dependence has to be interpreted as a choice of framing for my original bosonic observable. Okay. All right. So in fact, one of the motivations for this project was just to, given this kind of supersymmetric formalism, just to do computations to check, for instance, that this statement about independence of beta is actually true, to see how, and to understand how that works. Because it's very non-obvious, just from doing perturbation theory with beta equals I, that the result doesn't depend at all on the choice of H in this kind of 2D Yang-Mills term. Okay, so let me say a little bit about perturbation theory then with this action. So of course, perturbation theory is just one tries to crank to a certain extent. So So of course, what we do is we pick some. So I should say that the equations of motion, the critical points for that modified action, just say that the connection is flat. For all values of beta, they just still say that the connection is flat. So the critical points actually don't change. So we just do perturbation theory around some flat connection A naught, which I'll just choose to be the trivial connection. So I'll write A is equal to A naught plus B. B is the perturbation. And I'll always work in a gauge. I'll always work in this horizontal gauge where I say that the contraction of B is equal to 0. So B only has legs on the contact planes. OK, and then so let me just write down so you can think about perturbation theory what the gauge fix action for B will look like. So M is still a general contact three manifold. So the kinetic piece of the action, all right, is B wedge curly D subscript beta B minus I beta over 2 kappa wedge B wedge, something I'll call star H DH dagger of B plus I plus the interaction pieces I beta over 2 integral over M kappa wedge trace, and then there's from the Yang-Mills term DH beta wedge star H commutator beta beta plus 1/4 beta beta wedge star H beta. So modulo, actually, there's some problem with my notation, which is that in the paper, beta and B look different. But here, beta and B, unfortunately, my notation look the same. Yeah. So basically, the beta dependence is very simple, just an overall coefficient, except there's some beta dependence in this operator. All right, so the form of this action should be very familiar. So this term that I've written here is just a gauge fixing term. So if we fix this horizontal gauge, but there's still basically planar gauge transformations, two-dimensional gauge transformations. So this just effectively fixed harmonic gauge, the analog of harmonic gauge on the contact plane H. And then this cubic term, just basically it's an analog, it's basically a 2D Yang-Mills vertex on H, and then there's the usual quartic Yang-Mills vertex all on H. And I should say, in all this action, there's some ghosts, which we don't bother to write. OK, so this is the structure of the action. To really kind of get into the meat of the perturbation, I need to tell you a little bit about what the propagator. The propagator comes from this stuff here. The propagator is always called K. So let me tell you about the propagator and also about the geometric operators that appear in that action. So there are really three contact operators that I have to tell you about to make sense of this action. OK, so the first thing that appears in this action is all these star of H's that I write everywhere. Star H is just a version of the Hodge operator, which basically acts like the Hodge duality operator in two dimensions on the contact planes. So it's an operator which takes zero forms on M to two forms and acts, for example, by star of H of 1 is this two form d kappa, which is the area form on the plane. And then it acts from one forms of M to one forms just by the complex structure on the planes. And it annihilates the top forms. And so one can, if one wants a formula. So I do this, to do the gauge fix now again, I have to pick some contact metric. And with respect to that three-dimensional metric, the star of H is the three-dimensional Hodge star acting on kappa, which whatever it acts on. So this contact operator is just a Hodge operator on the contact planes. And then, the other ingredients, so there are these things are called DH. DH dagger will just be the Hodge dual with respect to this Hodge star H of DH. I just need to tell you about DH. And DH is a horizontal, it's a version of the Durham operator. It's called the horizontal Durham operator. And so what DH is DH is just a projection of the usual Durham D onto the forms which lie in the kernel of the Reib contraction, because we always want to preserve this condition. So DH, as I say, it's just a projection onto the kernel of the Reib contraction. So it's just D minus, if one wants a formula, kappa wedge contraction D. So that does the projection. Okay, so the really interesting operator to talk about is the is this thing which I call curly D here. Curly D plays the analog of the Drom operator and the usual Chern-Simons formalism, but it looks quite a bit different. So curly D, sometimes some people call curly D just the contact operator. Other people might call it the Ruhmann operator. Ruhmann was the guy who introduced it in 1994. Okay, so curly D, first of all, let me tell you where curly D acts. So curly D is an operator which acts from the space of one forms on M, which satisfy this horizontal condition. So they lie in the kernel of contraction with the Reed field, to the space of what are usually called vertical two forms on M. So vertical two forms are just the two forms which lie in the image of the operator that's take the wedge product with kappa. And then so what how and then so DB has some formula. So here's the formula. So DB is equal to kappa wedge. So the image lies in kappa, so there's a kappa wedge and there's some stuff. Lie derivative along the Reed field minus I beta over 2 dH star H. DH. All right, so this is exactly, there's no mystery about where this operator comes from. This piece of the operator just comes from the Chern-Simons term and when we go to the horizontal gauge. And then this piece is just the coming from the 2D Yang-Mills term. And then when we do this horizontal gauge fixing, we have this part. We basically find in the full kinetic term a kind of analog of the two-dimensional Laplacian on the contact forms plus this Reed derivative term.
Is there any simple expression for the propagator?
I'm getting to that, actually. Yes, the answer is there is an analog expression for the propagator for all values of beta. Although that is not the most useful expression. I'll get there in just a second, actually. In 5 minutes, I guess. To say one more word about this thing, DB, there's some nice feature of DB, which is if I pick the special value, beta is equal to I, this actually extends to a complex. Where dH sits here, and then the ordinary Drom d sits here. Curly d is like the analog of the Drom operator. And what Ruhmann produced was an analog of the Drom complex, but now adapted to all this contact data. DB is not quite elliptic. It's hypoelliptic, which means it satisfies something like elliptic regularity, but it's not. It's not elliptic. It's more like, this operator does have a cohomology. And then the little theorem, which is not a difficult theorem, due to Ruhmann in 94, is that if you look at the cohomology of this complex, so just call it H contact, and it depends on M. It depends really on M in the contact form kappa. This is isomorphic to the usual Drom complex on M. And so in particular, it's independent of kappa. So this is, in a certain sense, the classical analog of what we want to understand about the perturbative invariance. We expect that the perturbative invariance should actually be a modulo framing topological invariance of the knot, independent of the contact structure. And here, basically, we see that sort of from the sort of classical just piece of our action, that the actual cohomology of this kinetic operator is the same as the Drom. Of course, it's really interesting. This curly D is a second-order operator. It's not like the Drom operator. It's a second-order operator. And the fact that this is a complex is kind of non-trivial. It only works if beta is equal to the special value I, and one has to do a little bit of work to show that basically that this term squared is zero. Okay. Right. Okay. So now to Kevin's question. Yeah. So the important thing here is now to ask. Okay. So great. So how do we invert? We want to actually do perturbation theory. The vertices are trivial. What we need is the propagator. And that's where all the anomaly comes from anyway, the asymptotic behavior of the propagator. So the real question is, what can we say about the inverse of, well, the gauge fixed version of dB here? Okay, maybe I'm not sure exactly where the time, maybe 5 more minutes. Or we can, you can stop me whenever. Yeah. Okay, so I'll just go on. So Kevin asked about the propagator. So once the first thing is that, yeah, for all values of beta, there is, one can write down an analytic expression in terms of elementary, more or less elementary functions for the inverse of this gauge fix dB. Actually, I did not plan to write it down. I can show you later if you want to see it. I didn't write it down in my notes. It's not, the reason I didn't write it down is not because it's difficult to write down, but it's not as useful as actually a perturbative expression for the propagator. So in a certain sense, it's easier to work with not the exact propagator, but the perturbative approximation of the propagator in the limit that beta is small. And if you want to, so what I actually want to talk about was this perturbative localization, which really happens when we think about the structure of this propagator for small beta. And actually, by the way, Kevin, when I say that you can write down the inverse of this propagator, what I mean is for the standard contact structure on R3.
Sure.
Yeah. And actually, it's possible in that case because, as I'll say in a second, that we can always choose this contact structure and contact metric over there to respect a large group of symmetries. So we give R3 its Lie group structures, the Heisenberg Lie group. Everything can be made invariant under the Heisenberg symmetry, and so that's basically why there's a, because that's simply why the PDE for this inverse of D can be solved. Okay, but anyway, let's say it's better actually not to do that. It's better to just do a simple mind and think about what happens when beta is small. And actually, to tell you the most important thing, all we should do is just look at this kinetic operator, the gauge fixed version of dB. Just look at how it acts. So rather than trying to write down the propagator in R3, we'll just try to look at the operator on R3. Okay, so I gauge fix it. Now the first thing to say is that with the right choice of gauge fixing, this operator has the nice property that preserves holomorphic, anti-holomorphic type on the contact plane. So I'm just going to write down how this operator acts on the 0-1 component of my gauge field B here. Actually, something really nice happens. I could write down equally well what happens to the 1-0 piece. But actually, in the limit that beta is small, the propagator for the 1-0 piece vanishes. So this propagator becomes chiral in the limit that beta becomes small. So that's a really nice feature of this field theory, of course. So really, the important piece is the 1-0 piece here. And so the way that this operator acts, just if you write things down in some coordinates, and the same coordinates that I chose over there. So the propagator looks like I plus beta dd tau, coming from that Lie derivative term over there, minus I beta, and then from basically the Hodge-Laplacian on the contact planes, I'll write a zz bar plus z bar z, all acting on this b01 just thought about as a function, where z here, the z's are vector fields, which span this contact plane, and basically act like the holomorphic, anti-holomorphic derivatives. So z, in terms of my coordinates, tau, zeta, and zeta bar, looks like dd zeta. It's like the holomorphic Dolbeau plus I zeta bar dd tau. And then z bar is just the conjugate. So z bar is equal to dd zeta bar minus I zeta dd tau. And so these span the contact planes. And in fact, they're, along with dd tau, give a left invariant frame for R3 as the Heisenberg Lie group.
So in this coordinate, which is the contact plane is which coordinates in the contact plane?
Yeah, you should check actually if I got my factors correct that actually that these things. Yeah. So if we got all the factors of two right, you'll find that these z and z bar lie in the kernel of kappa over there. Yeah, I mean basically see there's a zeta bar here because there when we contract with dz, there's the zeta and zeta bar here. So the contact planes, by the way, are always twisting. That's why there are these dd tau things here. It's because the Lie group structure is non-abelian. So this is these are left invariant Heisenberg vector field. So R3 is the Heisenberg Lie group. And of course, just see by looking at the bracket, ZZ bar, you see the Heisenberg algebra, I guess is minus I dd tau. So there's the non-abelian. Of course, also I should say what this says is that this two-plane distribution is everywhere non-integral. Z and Z bar never close to something tangent. And that's, of course, the basic sort of feature of contact structures. OK, so anyway, so this is what the operator anyway looks like in coordinates. And the important thing to observe is just the following. So if we take there's definitely we have a left invariant metric on that. All I'm doing is I'm just writing this operator. This is just a function. This is a function times this one form. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't even, I'm only writing this to emphasize that this operator preserves the type.
And you wrote it here as something from 1 to 2. Oh, you gauge fixed. I see. So
well, yes, actually, I should say this. That's a good point, actually. Yeah, so yeah, I should say, yeah, what I've done is I've used the metric actually to get myself back from here to here. Yeah, that's exactly what I've done. Yeah, actually, that's a good point. Yeah, I've used the metric to get myself back. Right, so the important feature of this propagator can be seen just by looking at, so we just think about the action of this operator. So. So the important thing is if we just look at it, there's an I here. And now when beta's small, this term, that beta doesn't matter. So we just have I times dd tau. And of course, everything else in the operator will be involve a beta here. But of course, dd tau is not a great operator. So we need to include at least these terms from the derivatives here. So we have dd tau minus, actually, I guess, 2 beta. Sorry?
If you just deduce dd tau, then the propagator will just go straight along tau.
That's right. Somehow that's like taking, not having the Yang-Mills term. Yeah. And so what we're going to do is get a regularized version of that. So you'll see in a second. So we have minus 2 beta. And then we have the Laplacian on the plane. And then we have stuff all acting on B01. And then we have stuff, I'll just write order zeta, which vanishes at the origin. So all the other stuff that comes from these vector fields involves these terms and just vanishes at the origin. So if we're near the origin, you can imagine our Wilson loop is we shrink it to be very tiny, so it's near very small near the origin, then basically our operator is just acting like the heat operator here. And of course, you know, if beta's small, the heat operator, the heat kernel will vanish very rapidly away from the origin. And one could argue basically that when that leading order heat kernel vanishes, if one chooses beta small enough, it's vanishing very far away from the origin, very fast as we move away from the origin, so these higher order terms in zeta don't matter. And so that suggests that this propagator for small beta can be approximated just by the heat kernel, on R3. And that's exactly right. That's what one finds when one takes this exact solution for beta and just does the asymptotic expansion for small beta. So the propagator behaves like a heat kernel, and then this perturbative limit of small beta is just a short time limit for the heat kernel where everything is very concentrated. Basically, nothing propagates very far from the origin. And so actually, there's actually a very beautiful cohomological description of that of this leading order beta, which maybe I'll end, which is kind of the punchline for this formalism. So to give kind of a precise description of what this propagator looks like for small beta and how it is like a heat kernel, the usual heat kernel, I can say the following. So here's our picture of R3 in the tau and zeta plane. Now, for the usual transignment theory, we basically made our propagator by cohomologically by pulling back the volume form on the two-sphere. This small beta propagator has a similar cohomological interpretation, but what we're doing is, exactly as Davide suggested, we're going to replace the two-sphere by the tangent plane to the sphere at the North Pole here. And so on this tangent plane, rather than working with the fundamental class of the two-sphere, let me introduce the Gaussian fundamental class of this plane. So call that omega beta. It depends on beta. Beta just sets the width of the Gaussian, I over 4 pi beta, e to the minus zeta squared over 2 beta, d zeta, which d zeta bar, so it's just proportional to the area form. And then what I do is, to make this leading order propagator, I consider a map, which is a kind of parabolic retraction map. Call it rho plus. It's a map from the upper half space in R3 to this tangent plane, just given by so what I do is I just divide zeta by root tau and zeta bar by root tau. So this map, I should say, this Heisenberg structure has an obvious symmetry, has a scaling symmetry for which tau has weight 2 and the zetas have weight 1. So there's a kind of funny kind of, it's not sort of the Euclidean scaling symmetry, it's this sort of, I guess some people call it Lifshitz scaling. Yeah. Yeah, so that's Lifshitz scaling built into this theory, and that's why there are these roots here, and we respect that. So everything I'm doing is kind of respects the Heisenberg structure. And then I make now my a form, the heat form, on the punctured R3, I'll call it chi beta, just by saying that I'm under this retraction map from the upper half space to R2, I pull back the Gaussian fundamental class, omega beta, for positive tau. And then I just extend by 0, as usual for the heat equation, I just extend by 0 for negative tau. And as usual, it's just smooth because of the heat curl. Okay, so then what this propagator and the small beta limit then is, so I make it basically in exactly the same way the standard turns Simon's propagator looks when we think about it cohomologically, except there's one little thing I have to do. So I want now, of course, to make to pull this two form back to the product of two copies of R3. But the way I should do this is I should use not the abelian Lie group structure where we take sort of differences x minus y, but we should take differences in the Heisenberg sense. We have the Heisenberg symmetry, so we have to take differences for Heisenberg group elements. So there's a Heisenberg difference map called gamma from H3 times H3, subtract the diagonal to H3, and we just make a left invariant difference. So gamma of two points x1 and x2 in the Heisenberg in R3 with this Heisenberg structure. It's just the Heisenberg inverse of x2, Heisenberg multiplication with x1. Yeah, I knew you'd ask that. So here it is. So where? It's nothing fancy. That's the thing. It's nothing fancy. It's just so tau 1, zeta 1. Here's the multiplication. Dot tau 2, zeta 2. It's almost the abelian sort of multiple. Well, it's almost. So basically, tau 1, zeta 1 and zeta 2 add in the usual way. But tau 1 and tau 2, the sum depends on zeta. So it's equal to, in some normalizations, imaginary part of zeta 1, zeta 2 bar. So this is a rotation invariant way to do things. And then zeta 1 and zeta 2 add in the usual way. OK, so basically, this is nothing fancy about this. Just, and then the inverse is just the inverse is the normal inverse. So x inverse in the Heisenberg sense is just minus x in the usual vector space. Okay, so this just specifies the pullback matter, and then I can say.
Formal example to the formula in this Heisenberg setup and supergroup and superspace, right?
Yes, yeah.
Like Z and the bar, like the are like bosonic versions of superspace variables. So like this is the theta 1 minus tau 2 plus.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Theta 1, theta bar 2. One, which will be the superspace distance.
That's right, I see.
They were literally
the DMD bar.
Yeah. I see, that's a good, I see. Okay, yeah, that's right. Okay, yeah, so we have, yeah, we're doing, everything's bosonic here though. Right, so yeah, so just to kind of, to, yeah, maybe to finish the statement. So the statement is just that it's a leading order in small beta. So for this inverse to the this propagator is just the pullback under this Heisenberg difference map of the heat form beta. So the kind of point of this formula is just to that when beta, yeah. So the point of this formula is that if we want to study things in perturbation theory with small beta, nothing propagates very far because the propagator is pulling back from this little tiny concentrated delta function there at the North Pole. And so, for instance, if one wants to, for example, for this Legendrian setup, if one wants to compute, say, again, the kind of the leading order, kind of the most, the sort of the first invariant that you would meet, this invariant. So of course, the naive way to do it would just be to say, again, we just integrate over the torus minus the diagonal of this propagator, this Heisenberg propagator for small beta. And so, of course, in this case, what happens is that this form just concentrates on all the points in space which project to the same point on the knot, right? So basically, they're contributions from either the crossings or possibly from a neighborhood of the diagonal. And in this case, because of the Heisenberg symmetry, actually, there's no contribution from the diagonal, and there are only contributions from the crossing. And so what one finds is it's just a sum over the local, so one finds just a sum over the crossings of the local writhe of the crossing. So just the so we attach signs in some standard way to the crossings here. So just whether or not the crossing in the plane is right-handed or left-handed, we attach a sign, and then we just sum up over all those signs. And so for a topological knot, this would not be a knot invariant, the writhe of the planar projection, because it obviously changes under the first Rademeister move. Right? So it's not an invariant. But actually, for Legendrian knots, this is one of the most basic Legendrian invariants. So this is a Legendrian invariant applied to this particular projection, which is the Thurston-Benequin invariant. And it's exactly the same as the self-linking number if we use the rev framing of this picture. So the rev framing would just be the vertical framing out of the blackboard. That's kind of a standard fact that the writhe of a plane projection is the same as the self-linking number with the vertical vector field. So anyway, so this formalism does, without any kind of counterterms or any kind of explicit framing, produce a Legendrian invariance. It has a nice feature. You see that all this localization of the propagator, of course, this localization is a feature of the propagator, which means it happens at all orders in perturbation theory. We just take beta to be small, and all the contributions from the diagrams localize onto the points which all crush together over the knot. So basically, yeah, order by order in perturbation theory, you're producing measures on this immersed plane curve.
Okay, this is the regularization of the axial
Exactly right. That's exactly what it is. It's just a regularization of axial gauge for Chern-Simons theory. And in fact, for people, if you know, people have thought about this idea of like basically collapsing this fundamental class of the two-sphere to this little point up here and working in axial gauge. But this formalism basically just gives you the right, it's kind of the right geometric way to do it to make them not Legendrian and to work with this particular contact geometry. It's like they're sort of putting all those old ideas into the right right framework. And I say it all comes, it also, and it's all sort of in the upstairs, and the UV is required by supersymmetry. So it's all somehow that's the structure that's really going on.
Now you're going to get that matrix.
I don't know where. Yeah, I don't know. Actually, I don't. Yeah, I don't know where.
I mean, so that procedure to compute Jones will not have saved by so say some. Like,
yes. Of course.
Presumably, this is going to reproduce those.
I don't know.
It's not on the plane, right? So that's exactly what Stitt's model is. You can come up here or not. Or you can be an icon. If you just have to braid the two strands, then you can do these two, right? Some space.
I'm actually not sure that Legendre knots can be braided. That's actually a kind of, I'm kind of skeptical.
I mean, what's wrong with just taking this picture and like focusing on the little part of it and putting space at the end?
No, you can certainly do that. Yeah, no, you can certainly take this picture in the plane. Yeah, no, you can certainly cut this picture up in the plane. In space. I actually don't know whether or not this actually leads to the.
Spaghettos only go vertical.
That's right, they only go vertically, yeah.
So ultimately, near each cost in your perturbation theory, you produce some
Well, the thing is the diagonal. I don't know that it all orders the diagonal. So there's also a local measure in general.
Yes.
In fact, if I were to change this Heisenberg map a little bit, so it basically destroys the symmetry, if I were to change this map a little bit, basically if I were to adjust this coefficient by a little bit and just do this computation, then there would be a contribution from the diagonal. And so then I'd find actually a different Legendrian invariant. So we're not finished with the power of computation. I don't know whether or not the diagonal contribution actually vanishes to all orders in perturbation theory. Yeah, you're right. If modulo the diagonal, everything would come from the crossings, but there is the kind of the most degenerate place. That's right. You give something locally integrated over the curve, and there are known, it's one question people ask is just how do you make invariants of immersed plane curves? And it is known how to make invariants of Vasiliev style invariants of immersed plane curves precisely by measures on the curve, which have some atomic support at the crossings and some. Yeah, so I'm not actually totally certain that this leads the army. Yeah, we haven't gone far enough in perturbation theory to tell exactly if this leads to the R matrix or something, or just a different way, whether you can see the R matrix or just a different way to think about the Vasiliev invariants. Yes, we've gone over anyway.
Any more questions?
Yeah.